Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 27th of February, and a little later, continuing, on the 1st of March, 2014. This is Nav Briefing number 113, What's It to Her? So, here we are, counting down the last, quarter of the last second of the 10 seconds of reset, which amounts to 3 years in human linear time. Well, I don't know how you're doing out there, but it's pretty tense and suspenseful from where I'm sitting. And at some moments, the accumulated anticipation of this experiment is positively unbearable. I've never been through anything like this in my life, and, well, neither have you, have you? So here we are, and I'm holding steady at my post, along with my cats, and if I don't get shattered by the sheer intensity of it, well, I think that I'll probably get through to the culminating moment of reset. Right now, I'm speaking to you in the completion of the Matangi shift. This morning I observed the sunrise crescent, probably for the last time. It will probably be too thin to be observed tomorrow morning. It's now about 8 o'clock in the evening here in Spain. And today, I note from my ragged calendar of GNE moments that there is a perigee surge in 16 degrees of Aquarius in the arc of the goatfish. You might recall that I said that Venus attains the point of this perigee surge, which is the last perigee surge in reset, okay? Right now, today, Thursday, the 27th, the last perigee surge in reset. And Venus reaches the degree where that perigee surge occurs on the 23rd of March. So I proposed that you can take the period of time from the 19th, which is the exact anniversary of the supermoon of 2011, and the 23rd to be the completion of reset and the beginning of correction. Don't have to be obsessive about nailing it down to a day and an hour. It lies, let's say that it lies in those 4 days. I would like to say before I get into the specifics of this briefing that you must have been very patient with me throughout this experiment in order to stick with it until this moment. You recall how I described the factor of anticipation, how anticipation works in the human psyche, and how it plays into the practice of the GNE. Well, needless to say, there's been a huge anticipation created leading up to the moment when correction begins. I'd like to remind you, too, that I haven't been totally consistent in reporting on the perigee surges. I think I've reported or commented on most of the apogee moments. But there are a good number of the perigee moments that just went by without me commenting, even though I may have made a briefing at the day it occurred or close to that day. Well, as you know, it's really difficult for the human animal to follow the operations of the first attention of the Aeon Sophia. The key syntax for the first attention of the Wisdom Goddess is divine alchemy. What exactly does that mean? Well, I think in the perspective of the GNE now, with 3 years, almost three complete years behind us, we can understand that it means that she is using her dreaming attention to redesign and reconfigure the experiment into which we have been placed. You might have noted that I said not too long ago in one of these briefings, I referred to the first attention as the dreaming, designing attention. Now that description might have confused you a little bit because we have come to identify the dreaming power of the Aeon Sophia and even of the human animal with the second attention, haven't we? So the second attention can also be called the dreaming attention. But you see, the first attention is also an aspect of her dreaming. It's just a different aspect. All three attentions are modalities of the dreaming power of the Aeon Sophia. They are modalities of her aeonic emanation. Emanation and dreaming are virtually the same terms in the GNE, in planetary tantra, and most certainly in Hindu metaphysics, which presents a kind of ancient prefiguration of planetary tantra in some ways. You know that you find in Hindu mythology the image of Vishnu, the dreaming god. Vishnu dreams the universe. He dreams all the worlds and all the characters in those worlds. And images of the dreaming Vishnu are common in Hindu art. So the notion that we are in the dream of a divine being can be originally found in Hinduism, if you like to go back and identify or locate things in that manner. Sure, go right ahead. When we come forward to the Gnostics and the Teleste of the mystery schools, well, ha! I mean, you find that notion of the dreaming deity, the oneiric concept of reality, O-N-E-I-R-I-C, referring to oneiros or dream, you find that concept elaborated in a most spectacular manner, don't you? So we can say in planetary tantra quite comfortably, and we can sit around comfortably and lounge in a casual and voluptuary fashion upon the earth, knowing that we are characters being dreamed at that very moment, knowing explicitly, intellectually, but also somatically and sensorially, that we are biological and material characters dreamed on a vast wave of aeonic power. The power of the emanation of the Aeon Sophia, the power of the emanation of Selete, of which I'm going to be speaking one of these days, and of the entire company of the Pleromic Aeons saturates the entire universe. And in particular, it saturates that little corner of the universe where we live on a planet that participates in a solar system embedded in the interstellar space of the third galactic arm of a lenticular spiral, which itself is embedded in intergalactic space, out to the boundless limits of the universe. A universe without bounds. There are no limits. All of that that occurs in the universe, in the myriad worlds, is sustained by the power of aeonic dreaming. And the power of aeonic dreaming is a spontaneous eruption from the originator. So, the particular science that you want to master and the particular art that you want to master involves, among other things, it involves the recognition and mastery of the three attentions of the human animal as they may be engaged with the three attentions of the wisdom goddess. Now, recall that planetary tantra can be defined as interactive magic with Gaia. Certainly, those three attentions are the modalities of interactivity. They're the gears. They're the engagement gears, as it were. And as I've said before, the easiest one to follow and track is the second attention, the dreaming attention. The mysteries of the first attention, on the other hand, are deeply hidden and concealed. They're deeply occult. So, short of going into a telestic trance, it is pretty difficult to bring into human conception what the Aeon Sophia may be doing with her first attention at any particular moment. We can conceptualize what she might be doing, but it's really difficult, without entering an altered state of concentration, to be a direct witness to what she is doing. You see the difference? So, for instance, in the case of Fukushima, Mon Amour, we can conceptualize that she is doing something with what is called radioactivity, that it has a purpose for her, and that she operates with it on the level of the first attention to bring forth accelerated mutations in the species, as well as possibly extinctions. Mutations, extinctions, and the regeneration of species, all species, including the anthropos. Well, that's it. That's the activity of her first attention. I can say that is what she is doing, but I cannot tell you how she is doing it. How are we going to know then how she is doing it? How are we going to know, as we enter correction, how she is undertaking the transmutation of the human species to Anthropos 11? Well, that's the big question. And that's the question that I would like you to carry in your minds down to the completion of this experiment to March 19th of next month. How is the Aeon Sophia proceeding with the mutations to produce Anthropos 11? 11 minutes of her time before the conclusion of this aeonic day. How is she proceeding to produce that mutation, and what conditions in the atmosphere is she preparing to be favorable to that mutation? If you have enjoyed the GNE so far, if you have learned from it, and if you have primed your intelligence and your passion to the great learning adventure, then you can easily go the rest of your life with that question. It's pointless to speculate. No sense in playing around with metaphysics. Don't go outside the narrative, and you don't have to go outside PT either in order to investigate and explore those questions. The point, as Rilke advised, is to live the questions. Sometimes there will be answers. I already have some answers for you. You already have some answers. I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. I'm absolutely certain of that. You already have some ways of understanding in the concrete particulars of your lives regarding the air you breathe, the world you see around you, regarding your interactions with other animals, including the human animal, regarding what you eat, regarding the energy that you feel in your body, regarding your health or your lack of health, regarding all those concrete things, wisdom comes to you and she reveals to you the ways of operation of her first attention. Remember the alchemical rule. Let thine operations be guided by nature and by the true and not the fantastic imagination. Follow that rule. And it will be practical and real and concrete, moment by moment. In the solidarity of Planetary Tantra, we'll all have the opportunity to share what we learn. I can sense that there's a great abundance of learning and wisdom being prepared for those who can stand for the Anthropos. Remember, you're not the Anthropos just because you're born as a human animal. It's an existential stance. It's an identity that you assume. And that too, assuming the identity of the Anthropos, that too is an act of imagination, isn't it? In the first place, when you adopt or assume the identity of the Anthropos, you have a picture of how the Anthropos was created, given in the sacred narrative. You see? And you have to imagine that. You have to imagine Sophia and Thelete in the pleromic core before any of the planetary systems that received the Anthropos plasm before it had been seeded in the Orion Nebula and before any planetary systems had received it. You have to imagine that. And then you have to imagine that there were 9 previous experiments, 9 previous seedings, panspermic events in various planetary worlds in this galaxy. Stay local, stay in the backyard of your own galaxy. Because if you don't know what's happening in your own galaxy, you're not going to be able to figure out anything that's happening anywhere else in the universe. You know? So, when you identify with the Anthropos, as far as its origin is concerned, then you have the basis to carry that identification forward to the present moment. The moment of the mutation or transmutation of Anthropos 10, who began this experiment, to Anthropos 11, who is going to complete this experiment according to the conditions of her reset. And that is the proof of divine alchemy. You are the proof of divine alchemy, and it's not a proof that happens just once or in one moment or in some blazing insight or some thrilling moment of cosmic realization or cosmic empathy when you plunge into the oceanic feeling, as William James described it, in the varieties of religious experience. No, it's every single moment for the rest of your life. It builds. Not to put too strong a point on it, but indeed, it builds. It does build. And one of the secrets that becomes an experiential revelation in the divine alchemy of this planet is that the alchemy, in its diverse aspects, the alchemy of the wisdom goddess, evolves through you. You don't develop or evolve it for yourself. You don't even develop it. It's evolving through you. And what you do is register that process. And the proof that you have really registered it, the proof that you have really engaged in her divine alchemy, pervading the entire habitat of life, and extending also into the realms of inorganic life, the proof that you engage it is that it builds. So your task is not to develop anything. It develops on its own, like everything else in the natural world. Look around you. It's all the potatoes, them potatoes that they carve into spuds down there below deck. They developed on their own somewhere, and some landlubbers picked them for us, didn't they? The butterflies and the bees, they develop on their own, the snakes, the fish in the sea, the cloud formations in the course of the day, the weather, the viruses, the microbial forms of life, the moss, the scum. It all develops on its own. Look around. Well, likewise, her divine alchemy, of which you are the artifacts, to use the correct alchemical term from medieval language, develops on its own. You're not becoming an empowered person by realizing what this divine alchemy is and how it operates. There's nothing personal about it, actually. It's transpersonal. So it develops through you, and you engage in that process. And the simple proof that you are engaged is that you feel it build, and you see it build, and it builds in your mind and body simultaneously. Enlightenment builds. I've said this before in reference to my experience of the Rhonda moment. It's not just a flash or summit experience that you have which fades away and ebbs away through the years. Oh no. It stays and it changes and it continues to get more and more intense. So what I have tried to say in describing planetary tantra and the dynamics of tantra in general, you know, tantra is transcendent physics. It's a transcendental form of physics, okay? What I've tried to explain, I don't know if I've been successful or not, is a simple and fundamental fact of experience that you are given the development of these processes by the planetary animal mother. Look at what she gives us, the human species and many other species as well. But just look at what she gives us for a moment. How things grow and you can eat them. Now, it's been said that agriculture was the downfall of the human race. In fact, if we didn't have agriculture and we knew how to do so, how to live without it, we could just gather, be hunters and gatherers, and just gather what she gives. Don't have to develop it. Don't have to develop bananas and corn. Well, now consider this. If she can just give you bananas and corn and cherries that fall into your hand in ripe clusters, then don't you think she can give you the processes of her innermost alchemical dynamics? Yeah, she can give you that too. But that requires that you show up to receive it. And this is the beauty and simplicity of this experiment. In this fact, I'm trying to get across now, is the beauty and simplicity of this experiment, which is namely that it develops in you, and all you have to do is register that first, and then hang with it. Tantra comes, I've said this before, the instructions of planetary tantra come at the highest level. They come at the level of completion, distillation, and perfection of knowledge. There is no gradient in this practice. And the challenge of the practice is, can you hold to that level of perfection? Can you hold to that level of intensity? This is the challenge of Tantra. You know, the Tibetans use this term, Dzogchen, which is supposed to translate into something like the great perfection. Well, as I realized at the Rhonda moment, 2:42 in the afternoon on July 21st, 2008, that it's not the great perfection. It's the great perfecting. It's the perpetual perfecting. So she is already perfect in all of her operations, even within the material immanence of the planet. As far as human terms are concerned, she's already perfect. But the perfection doesn't stop at a state of terminal perfection. It keeps perfecting itself even more. And that it does through the hunger or craving or addiction to behold its own beauty and to consume that beauty and be consumed in turn. Such is my instruction from the Rhonda moment. And you can happily and easily generalize that instruction to the topic of Gaian alchemy. This is now our topic, returning to the anniversary of Fukushima. This is now the topic I propose to you to carry forward into correction. How can we be involved in her divine alchemy at the level of the first attention? Well, the way to do it is simple. You ask this question whenever you look at anything in the natural world. For instance, just look at a tree and you ask, what's it to her? What is a tree to her? The Aeon Sophia. You sit by the ocean on some ledges, maybe the headlands of Mendocino, where I used to sit at times, where I would go to gather long reeds, reed stalks, for the oracle of the I Ching. I did it with yarrow reeds that I gathered on the headlands of Mendocino with Jan Kerouac. And then we would sit there, those spectacular cliffs, and look at the ocean. And if you ever do something like that now, while you're gazing at the ocean, you want to say, what's it to her? What is the ocean to her? Well, it's her emotional memory. When you look at the moon, what is the moon to her? Well, it's the outrigged steering device for the planetary body. And so on. This question, this simple question, can be applied to anything in the world. Oxygen. What is oxygen to her? What is nitrogen to her? Live with those questions for the rest of your life. And you, if you get an answer to one of them, or two or three, you can consider yourself to be a rich, fabulously wealthy human being. And I say to you that through teamwork and through combined determination and combined learning and teaching, many, many of the elements of this world, the physical and material elements, can be understood as what they are to her. But I tell you, just as a final observation, that if you wish to have those observations and realizations, if you wish to be enlightened as an alchemist, then you're going to have to be able to handle the intensity that goes with that learning process. The learning and the revelation of her method and of her natural, miraculous tantra is given to you. But what she requires is that you have the stamina to hold the intensity it takes to hold that knowledge and live it. So, as I proceed with the remaining 45 minutes or so of this briefing, let's return to the wonderful story of Fukushima, Mon Amour. You may recall that I noted with delight that at the moment of the Fukushima event, around 3 p.m, the moon was visible in the sky above that place, and it was actually standing in close conjunction to the Pleiades. Well, we came to know in September of 2012, remember, that the Pleiades marks the top of the celestial anchor, which may also be considered as a cosmic antenna that allows for a two-way signaling system between the planet Earth and the center of our galaxy. That is actually the fabled, quote, galactic alignment, unquote, of which there was so much debate and discussion leading up to December 2012. Well, we beat them all to the punch, didn't we? Because in the first week of September 2012, bingo, there was the celestial anchor. The key factor that allowed the visual identification of the anchor was the precise position of Jupiter at that time on the vertical axis of the anchor, the stem of the anchor. And it's no small coincidence that within a few days of recognition of the celestial anchor, there occurred a completely anomalous and inexplicable explosion in the atmosphere of Jupiter. So the Pleiades represents the top of the celestial antenna. And Sophia's sonic boom was the first signal sent to the Pleroma before the antenna was constructed. So I would suppose that the antenna came to be constructed in that period of time from the 11th of March 2011 till the first week in September 2012, about 18 months. When Sophia sent out the sonic signal to the Pleromic Center, timed exactly to the Fukushima event, then the conditions were established for correction to begin. And the construction of the antenna for pleromic relay is essential to her correction. So there you go, I rest my case. The logic of those events and the coherence, the logical coherence of those events should be obvious. When you look at Fukushima in that way, then you have a narrative choice. You don't have to buy into the Fukushima my catastrophe scenario, Fukushima my annihilation. You don't have to have a story with that title. You can have a story with the title Fukushima Mon Amour. What we are considering, and we have the privilege to consider regarding the Fukushima event, may come under the consideration of larger numbers of people in future time, and perhaps sooner rather than later. I don't really know. But at this time, right now, we have the privilege of considering that the Fukushima event was not a man-made accident, but it was a kind of accident if it was produced by the sonic boom from the interior of the Earth at the moment that the velocity of the barycenter exceeded the speed of sound. So we have the privilege to consider that whatever caused the destruction of those nuclear power plants on the shore at Fukushima, whatever event caused their destruction, whether it was really a normal earthquake, it doesn't appear to have been a normal earthquake, because many people argue that there are the signs of a normal earthquake are missing. There was some kind of seismic / sonic event, some kind, and then there was undoubtedly a tsunami wave of considerable force following that event. But we have the opportunity to consider that accident which destroyed the human-made facilities at Fukushima, damaged them, may have been a side effect of Sophia's sonic boom. And that's a really interesting thing to consider, isn't it? Because you have to ask yourself, well, I mean, it's really mysterious, isn't it? If you look at it that way. Because you have to say, well, wait a minute. What am I saying, you know? What is John saying? Or what are you saying when you run over this in your mind? Are you saying that She deliberately caused the accident at Fukushima to deliberately release the radioactivity, to deliberately provoke a catastrophic planetary situation in which humanity has to face what is radioactivity so that we can come to understand the alchemical transformations that ensue from the operations of her first attention. Or was it, could it have been that? Or could it have been a little different? Let's say that she didn't intend to set off a geophysical reaction that would devastate the nuclear plants at Fukushima. She didn't intend to do that specific thing, to have that specific result. But there is something fantastically magical and synchronistic and at the same time fantastically empirical in the fact that the two events coincide and that the timing of them displays the timing of those events, the sonic boom and the Fukushima catastrophe displays the Fibonacci series, which is the signature of aeonic dreaming. I mean, it's so big that you can't get your mind around it. I can't. But I love to just sit back and look at it and contemplate it. Now, I know, let me tell you, I've said before, that as the primary, who knows, I'm maybe the only, I don't know, as the primary proponent of the application of Joseph Campbell's creative mythology, the application and implementation of it, I am the most rigorous critic of myself. I know that the proposition or claim, to use the common word, that Sophia's sonic boom produced the event at Fukushima is non-falsifiable. I know that. And you know, non-falsifiable propositions are not necessarily good propositions and don't lead to science. Go read about Karl Popper's definition of non-falsifiable propositions, you know. The Lord God, creator, without the help of a female counterpart, created the entire universe in 7 days. That's a non-falsifiable proposition. And you see the trouble that human animals can get into with those kind of propositions. So I want to make it clear to you that here on the threshold of Gaian alchemy, we might be starting out with some non-falsifiable propositions because we're working in the genre of creative mythology. And you don't verify mythological propositions in the same way that you verify hard science, do you? Nevertheless, mythological propositions and hard science are not irreconcilable. Proof? Look at the Sophianic vision story. It's not just a massive, magnificent feat of mythic imagination, but it is also a verifiable astronomical story, you see? So we're already on the right track there, folks. But true, I must admit, in all humility, and as my own best or worst critic, that this proposition concerning the intentionality of the Aeon Sophia and the Fukushima accident is non-falsifiable. But at least if you're willing to consider it and investigate it and maybe move forward to the proof, well then, that's a path of experience. Anyone who is not willing to investigate it and who would refuse it out of hand is excluded from that path of experience and experimentation that would prove indeed if we do have the capacity to realize the divine alchemy that operates on this planet, the super nature of nature. Okay? Fukushima is the deal breaker. If you are a blind materialistic and a Cartesian who thinks that matter is dumb and inert, then you are going to be spun by that narrative out of Sophia's correction. But if you are willing to consider that everything is material, beginning to get, see what I mean when I say that? If you're willing to consider that everything is material and matter is alive and conscious and sentient and self-organizing in every respect, from the microbial and microscopic levels out to the macrocosmic level, then you're on. Then you're in the narrative that leads to the investigation and proof of her divine alchemy. And it may be proven along that adventure, along that path of discovery, it may be proven that the human animal is in some manner a unique instrument of her alchemy. And we would know then how we are so. Right now, I can't say how regarding a lot of Gaia's alchemy. I can say what, okay? For instance, I said, what is the radioactivity, so-called radioactivity, that we're supposed to be so afraid of? What is it? And I could say, it is the evidence of bionic excitation that she uses in order to produce accelerated transmutations and to produce immediate extinctions, as well as the regeneration of life forms out of extinction. So I can say that's what radioactivity really is. But I can't tell you exactly how it works, because discovering the how and the why, that is to say, why she does that particular thing in that particular way, well, that's the art of Gaian alchemy. We are on the threshold of Gaian alchemy, and Fukushima is the key to that adventure. So, I'd like to say now, in the time remaining, that the key to Fukushima is iodine. What's it to her? It's the breath of the planetary animal mother. Iodine is her breath. There is nothing immaterial in the universe. Everything is material and chemical. Nous, the divine intelligence of the aeons, is chemical. It is nucleic acid. So iodine is the chemical material of her breath. It's not symbolism I'm talking about here. I'm not saying iodine symbolizes her breath. I'm saying it is her breath. Now, it's a fact regarding Chernobyl that people today think that tens of thousands and in some cases hundreds of thousands of people died horribly due to the Chernobyl accident, which, by the way, in terms of the radiation it has produced, still stands far above Fukushima. I believe one of the distortions of Fukushima is the claim that the exposure to radiation from Fukushima is exponentially many times more than Chernobyl. There are some researchers who say that is not true. In any case, I understand the facts of radiation after effects at Chernobyl to be as follows. There were only about 50 people who died in direct contact with the catastrophic circumstances of the accident. Now, people can die, hundreds or thousands of people can die in any kind of accident involving industrial products and materials. So, the Fukushima accident, which was not a meltdown, it was not a quasi-atomic explosion that occurred because the plant failed, caused some 50 people to die who were involved with the accident. But then, over the ensuing years, did hundreds of thousands of people die? Did the ensuing generations show deformities? Did their DNA break down? Did they develop all kinds of ugly cancers? Did they were born with three eyes and eight fingers and tails and their toes woven together? No. No. There is no considerable or significant rise in cancers and diseases said to be related to radioactivity in the after effects of Chernobyl, as far as I know. There is a lot of many, many claims bloating the narrative about Chernobyl. But if you go back and look for the actual evidence for those claims, I don't know if you'll find it. I haven't found it. But what does exist as outstanding evidence are the cases reported to be in the range of some 6,000 of children around Chernobyl who drank the milk and contracted thyroid cancer. So there were 6,000 cases of thyroid cancer related to children drinking milk. So just take that fact on board and go investigate it and check it if it's right. And if it appears to be wrong, please inform me that I've not got my facts straight. Now, I would just like to point out that you would begin your study in Gaian alchemy wisely to find out what iodine is regarding all processes of life on Earth and the maintenance of the human body. If you do so, you might be staggered. Iodine is absolutely essential to every single biological process that occurs in the human body. It is a foundational chemical. There is obviously some intimate reaction between iodine and the thyroid, because thyroid disturbances, hyperthyroidism or hypothyroidism, can be treated by the administering of iodine. They don't have to be treated by surgical removal of the thymus and that sort of thing. So there's an intimate relation between the breath of the planetary animal mother and iodine and the thyroid. Well, why would that be? Well, go look at the thyroid gland and the parathyroids, which are four buttons attached to it. It has the shape of a cuff, a half cuff, not a full-size cuff. And the cuff is attached to the windpipe just below the larynx, or sound box, which is where you speak. So the breath of the human animal is converted from breath into speech in the larynx, and closely coupled with the larynx is the thyroid. So I put it to you, and I don't have any idea of the significance of what I'm going to say right now, but I put it to you that there is a connection between acoustical and sonic resonance and the function of the thyroid gland. Bear in mind also that the Vishuddha chakra, the 16-petal chakra of the throat lotus, has often been associated or correlated to the thyroid gland. You know that, don't you? And that chakra, of course, is, or happens to be, get this, oh happy day, the instrument of telepathy. I've said for many years that the way you consciously develop telepathy is by speaking subvocally through the throat chakra. You don't allow, you know, the words that you want to say, the words that I am saying now are formed by the expulsion of breath from my lungs moving through the larynx, the sound box. The breath, which is soundless, coming from my lungs, becomes sound, is converted into sound, into audible sound, acoustic signals in the larynx. And because I have learned to speak, as human animals do, which is one of their most complex accomplishments, then I can say these words you're hearing right now, but I could equally so not say anything at all aloud, but pronounce the same words subvocally and hold them in the larynx. And that's how I would be developing my telepathic capacity. So I propose to you that there is, and yours too, the universal telepathic capacity of the Anthropos depends on the larynx. So I propose to you that there is an intimate connection between the larynx and iodine and the breath of the planetary animal mother. And I propose to you that the high incidence of thyroid cancer, which is evidential from the Chernobyl event, is some kind of lesson in her transmutatory powers. We would need to know why thyroid is prone to become cancerous due to the effects of radiation, and then we would learn something about the positive transmutatory effects of radiation. Something along those lines, you see? So this is a way to proceed with the investigations of Gaian alchemy. This is one direction to proceed. Now, I would propose to you as essential reading and research material for the future a book called Minerals for the Genetic Code, subtitled An Exposition and Analysis of the Dr. Olry Standard Genetic Periodic Chart and the Physical, Chemical, and Biological Connection by Charles Walters. Okay. Now, I'm not going to go into any more particulars right now in this talk, because the briefing is almost over. That is to say, I'm not going to specify any more direct examples of what's it to her, except one. Have you ever heard of argon? Argon is a so-called noble gas, and it's one of the more significant or more preponderant components of the atmosphere of the Earth. Did you know that? In fact, there's more argon by percentage in the atmosphere of the Earth than there is carbon dioxide. To be precise, argon is the third most common gas in the composition of the Earth's atmosphere. And it's measured at about 0.93% or 9,300 parts per million. And that makes it almost 24 times as abundant as carbon dioxide. 24 times. So you hear a big roar about carbon dioxide. We know, of course, it's all a huge fraud. This anthropic global warming is a horrible scam. You know, people are caught in that. There's a massive controversy, a massive debate in our time about CO2. Well, why aren't people debating about argon? Because there's 24 times as much of it in the atmosphere. Is it just sitting there inertly doing nothing? I don't think so. So let's ask this question. What is argon to her? What is argon in the terrestrial alchemy of the Aeon Sophia? Well, granted that all budding Gaian alchemists have minerals for the genetic code on hand, we can go and look at what it says about argon on page 128. Not to say that the complete answer we're seeking will be found there, but let's suppose that this particular work contains some really significant clues, and I can guarantee you that it does. Here's the entry on argon. It's number 44 in the Olry Standard Genetic Periodic Chart. And interestingly, it is listed side by side with the amino acid arginine. So, quote, with its zero polarity, argon remains a mystery of sorts. It's always there, always presenting a noble gas with each breath. There seems to be no written information on the interaction of noble gases. This makes discovery a looked-for event, since for now we know of no real interplay in the human body. We breathe argon with every breath, while it is about 0.93% of our air we breathe. Classical chiropractic conditions of the lumbar four areas known to receive nerve fibers from this spinal segment are prostate gland muscles of the lower back and the sciatic nerve. End quote. What he's referring to in the final sentence is the correlations he makes between parts of the human body, in this case the lumbar four bone, and these various genetic and chemical components of nature. Well, I would point this out just in passing. He refers to the fact that the spinal segment wired to the prostate gland muscles in the lower back is in some way, in chiropractic work, apparently, connected to argon and arginine. And why would arginine be in there at all? Well, he doesn't explain why arginine would be in this entry, number 44, but I can explain it. Arginine is one of the major components of sperm, of semen produced in the male body in the prostate gland. To be precise, in male physiology, the prostate adds the component of arginine, and this is what gives to the male ejaculation the white or pearly look, and indeed its substance, which all lecherous teenagers know as Pearl Jam. While we're on this dicey subject, it may be worth noting as well that women also have the equivalent of prostate gland. Did you know that? What it's called, Skene's gland, S-K-E-N-E-S. It's the female equivalent to prostate, and indeed, it is dynamically the equivalent because it is the source or organ of female ejaculation, because females ejaculate. They squirt. It's vulgarly called squirting in porn jargon. So, we're looking at the ejaculatory fluids of both the male and female of the human species, connected with, by association, by a correlation, or to use the old-fashioned term, a correspondence to argon and arginine. Well, I can understand the connection of those organs to arginine. That's obvious, isn't it? But what is the connection of those organs and secretions to argon? And why is there a correlation between arginine and argon? Well, I can't answer that question, but I can tell you what argon is to her. It is the secretion of that part of human consciousness that engages into the syntax of her own dreaming. So, humans have consciousness, which is chemical. You have consciousness because it is chemical. Everything is material. Your consciousness is chemical. And if you have some other kind of consciousness outside the human body, that's also material, but it's just material in a different way. So one of the mistakes, the universal errors of mysticism, has been due to the fact that it is possible to have out of the body and apparently non-corporeal states of consciousness. But just because the materiality of those apparently non-material states of consciousness is not detected doesn't mean that it does not exist. So in the case of the incarnate human animal, we know that your thoughts and memories are material and chemical. They are electrochemical processes and substances operating in your brain and your mind while you are alive. When those processes engage into the syntax of Sophia's dreaming, that engagement produces a kind of secretion. Just as there is a flow from axon to dendron in the human brain, there is a flow across the synaptic gap of energy and chemistry, there is likewise a flow, neurotransmitters flow across the synaptic gap, okay? Likewise, there is a synaptic gap between mentation and cerebration in the human animal and the chemistry of her dreaming in the atmosphere. And when the thinking of the human animal engages her syntax, there is a synaptic release in the atmosphere itself from the human animal. And that synaptic release causes the secretion of argon. And so argon accumulates in the atmosphere as a result of human mentation that reaches the syntax of the planetary dreaming dynamics. Now, that idea is not unique to me, but the way that I just stated it certainly is. I initially came across the rudimentary basis of that notion of what is argon to her, reading some obscure Brahminical literature in the library of the Theosophical Society in Adyar, Madras, when I was around 20. And there's a Sanskrit word that describes that secretion. There actually is, I swear. I can't remember what it is, and I've been looking for it for years. I think Dane Rudjar actually used that word once somewhere in his work, probably in the Planetarization of Consciousness. Anyway, mystics of the past, who are comparable to the alchemical mystics of Western tradition, have understood in meditative states that there is a physical transference of consciousness from the human animal into the atmosphere. And the evidence of that for the Aeon Sophia is the layer or component or constituent of argon. Now, this is about all I can say right now, so I only have about 5 minutes left here. But I certainly guess, that's an interesting syntax, that I might have caught your attention with this particular snippet of Gaian alchemy. And it gets better. Because if you can actually grasp that human animals secrete an element into the atmosphere that appears as argon, an atmospheric component 24 times more preponderant than carbon dioxide, then imagine what could be done using that component. What could be done with argon if we knew how to use it? Now, we know how to use oxygen. Obviously, we breathe it. We know how to use nitrogen and nitrous oxide, which is laughing gas, and various nefarious byproducts of nitrogen, right? It's like mustard gas and fertilizers. We know how to use some of the chemical components in the atmosphere, but we don't know how to use them in the life-generating dynamics of Gaian alchemy. If we did, we would be succeeding in this experiment on her terms, which, in fact, are simply not terms that she imposes upon the human animal at all, but they are the natural outcome of the occult capacities of the Anthropos. Occult meaning hidden or in a seed form, yet to be discovered and cultivated. That's all that occult means. So, where do we go from here? Well, let's consider the transmutation of Anthropos 10 into Anthropos 11. And let's consider what the Anthropia might be doing in her reset in order to, I really want to find the right word here. In order to optimize the advantages of human animals to reboot the experiment according to its perfect initial conditions. That would be like saying that you had a batch of seeds that you kept in your cupboard. Let's say that they were seeds of morning glory, and that they were kept in a dish, and for some reason or another, there were some other things in the dish, like sugar or some other elements, and the seeds of morning glory became disrupted and corrupted and infected in some way, so that they could not exhibit their original initial properties were they to be planted. Morning glory has psychedelic properties, by the way, as you may know. So you've got a problem with these morning glory seeds that were left in the cupboard, and you might have to throw them away because they have been contaminated or they have been infected in such a way that they cannot develop according to their initial potential. But suppose it were possible to clean out that tray, that dish, where you have kept the morning glory seeds, and in some manner to irradiate those morning glory seeds, to use a taboo term, to irradiate them in order to remove and purge those elements of contamination that have interfered with the functioning of the original phytochemical potentials of the morning glory seeds. Can you kind of see my drift? Would this be what she has done in correction? Would this be what she is doing? Remember, we can conceptualize what she is doing. You have to look at the entire atmospheric picture. You have to look at the compression of the atmosphere of the Earth. It's getting smaller. It's compressing like a shrinking ball. You have to look at the massive emissions of radon gas, the massive emissions from the smokers and from volcanoes. You have to look at the complete breakdown and reversal and repolarization of the geo-bio-electromagnetic field of the Earth. You have to look at all these things as the conditions that she consciously and deliberately has produced in order to bring the potential of the Anthropos back to its pristine condition to reboot the experiment 11 minutes before the end of the aeonic day, rather than at the end of the aeonic day. That's just a conceptualization of what she is doing or what she might be doing. And again, I grant you, come at me with any dismissal you like. I am the first one to be critical of my own propositions. That is a non falsifiable proposition, but I don't present it as absolute and biblical or scientific proof. I present it as an invitation to investigate and experiment. So we'll carry forward and go a little deeper into that invitation in the following talk, number 114. So it would be my intention now, in the 3 weeks remaining, to do that, to proceed in that way, to bring this experiment to its conclusion as the GNE within the given and stated time frame. And at its conclusion, one of the marks of success will be the excitement you feel to know that you are standing on the threshold of supernature and Sophianic alchemy. And so there is a happy ending and a great new beginning contained in the love story entitled Fukushima, Mon Amour.